Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. We'll be talking today about the 25th Amendment, the most recent addition to the Constitution. It allows for the removal of a president for a variety of reasons. In 2017, a few top officials of the Justice Department talked about possibly invoking it to remove President Trump. First, the recent background, then a discussion of the 25th Amendment and presidential power. Last year, President Trump fired Andrew McCabe as acting head of the FBI. McCabe had replaced James Comey, who was fired before him. This week, McCabe made headlines, talking about his new book titled The Threat. It describes the official suspicion that President Trump's relations with Russia might endanger national security. Here's McCabe telling 60 Minutes this week about an incident that caused them concern.
The president launched into several unrelated diatribes. One of those was commenting on the recent missile launches by the government of North Korea. And essentially, the president said he did not believe that the North Koreans had the capability to hit us here with ballistic missiles in the United States. And he did not believe that because President Putin had told him they did not. President Putin had told him that the North Koreans don't actually have those missiles. Intelligence officials in the briefing responded that that was not consistent with any of the intelligence our government possesses. To which the president replied, "I don't care. I believe Putin."
That's one example of why McCabe says he and others feared the president might have allegiance to a hostile foreign power. They wondered if that had something to do with James Comey being fired as head of the FBI. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was in the process of naming Robert Mueller as a special prosecutor, and McCabe says Rosenstein suggested wearing a listening device in conversations with President Trump.
The reason you would have someone wear a concealed recording device would be to collect evidence. And in this case, what was the true nature of the president's motivation in calling for the firing of Jim Comey?
Now, if evidence provided doubt about the president's loyalties, officials discussed invoking the 25th Amendment to remove him from office. But was Rosenstein's suggestion about wearing a wire all that serious? Here again is Andrew McCabe.
It was an unbelievably stressful time. I can't even describe for you how many things must have been coursing through the Deputy Attorney General's mind at that point. So it was really something that he kind of threw out in a very frenzied, chaotic conversation about where we were and what we needed to do next.
Adam Goldman covers the FBI for the New York Times. Citing unnamed sources last year, he broke the story that Rosenstein suggested wearing a wire when he talked to President Trump. I asked Goldman earlier if he found that level of stress in the Justice Department.
Yeah, this period after Comey is fired and the two weeks or so after that take place is really one of the more fascinating periods in the last 2 years in terms of what took place in the Justice Department. I mean, I think that, you know, the Justice Department and the FBI were somewhat unnerved by the circumstances. I think people have argued, or some would argue, that perhaps they panicked, right? That opening up on the president was a panic move, and appointing the special counsel might have been a move made out of panic too, given what the DOJ found and the FBI. But, you know, that time will tell whether it was the right decision or not.
So was it panic or something else? Some Trump supporters claim what really was going on was a conspiracy to remove Trump from office, involving the FBI leaders and others in what they call the deep state. Republican Lindsey Graham, now chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says he wants to look into that.
There's an allegation by the acting FBI director at the time that the deputy attorney general was basically trying to do an administrative coup, take the president down through the 25th Amendment process. The deputy attorney general denies it. So I promise your viewers the following, that we will have a hearing about who's telling the truth, what actually happened. Mr. Cabe, you remember, was dismissed from the FBI for leaking information to the press. So you got to remember the source here.
Now, some commentators on the far right claim the traditional news media were part of that conspiracy to accomplish the so-called administrative coup. I asked Adam Goldman of the New York Times what he thought about that.
I mean, it's nonsense. We're just reporting the facts as we know them without an agenda. I mean, one could make the same argument then, I suppose, that Breitbart, the Daily Caller, and all these right-wing proxies of the president and Republicans in Congress are engaged in similar things.
So how did all this get started?
So let's just back up here, okay? When I reported in September, nobody was calling it an administrative coup. People were like, oh, my God, I can't believe the New York Times is reporting this, particularly the left that seemed to be freaking out that I would report this and somehow endanger Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. But let's just be clear about what happened on this particular day, because I think there's been some confusion. So on May 16th, 2017, Rod Rosenstein, Andrew McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI, Tashina Gruar, who is Rod's national security advisor, and one other person, James Crowell, Rod's chief of staff, have a meeting. In that meeting, there are a couple of things said that Andy apparently takes note of and puts them in a memo. One is he writes down that apparently Rod Rosenstein suggested wearing a wire to record POTUS's true intention, POTUS being the president of the United States. And the other is what I've already quoted from his memo is, you know, this idea that Rod had discussed using the 25th Amendment to remove, you know, to get Trump out of office. So now there's a second meeting later that day with the same four people and two others. And the wire reference comes up again in that second meeting. So this is the extent of what we know about any discussions involving the 25th Amendment. I'm only aware of one discussion where it was briefly mentioned on the morning of May 16th.
Okay, so what do you think about the president's preference, we heard described by McCabe, for Vladimir Putin over his own intelligence agents with regard to North Korea's nuclear capacities?
Well, I don't know if that comment itself played a role in them opening up an investigation of the president. If it happened before they did, and before they opened the investigation of the president in May of 17, then possibly. I'm just not aware of that. I mean, it's clear though they did take a lot of the president's public comments were alarming to the FBI, which is why Trump's allies contend that this was the FBI basically having a foreign policy dispute with the president, and they didn't like the direction he was going in Russia, and they were going to stop it.
A lot has happened since all this took place. That was in 2017, of course, as you've reported. McCabe himself has been fired. Rod Rosenstein is about to retire, and his replacement has already been named, but will he in turn be fired by his new boss, Attorney General William Barr, before he gets a chance to retire? And will the report by the special prosecutor Mueller, appointed by Rosenstein, ever see the light of day?
It's our understanding Rod Rosenstein is going to be leaving the Department of Justice in mid-March. It's not clear if he'll be gone by the time the Mueller report is finished. I would be surprised if Barr fires him. But, you know, the president could be very angry about what he's reading involving the 25th Amendment. And clearly Rod talked to him about it and gave him his version. So perhaps the president doesn't believe him now, wants him out. That's a possibility. I think there'll be enormous pressure on Barr in terms of the Mueller report and not making it public. And I think the American public has a right and expectation to know what Mueller has been basically looking at for the last, you know, since May of 2017. So I think there's going to be a fair amount of pressure on Barr to make at least some of the findings public. And also, it's fair to the president too, right? You know, if Mueller didn't turn anything up in terms of core collusion with Russia, then I think, you know, it's fair to Trump too. Trump should want that out, and the American public should be able to know that there wasn't anything there or there was there. So we'll see what Barr does. I can't imagine him being able to successfully withhold this from Congress, or the next 2 years of his life are going to be miserable.
All right, Adam Goldman, thank you so much for all this background information. Once again, you've been covering the FBI for the New York Times and doing a great job of it. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and talk a bit about the 25th Amendment and presidential powers. This is To the Point. Warren Olney back with To the Point. We just heard about the new book, The Threat, by former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe. In it, he describes suspicions among a few senior officials in the Justice Department. Did President Trump's relations with Russia constitute a national security threat? They even discussed what it would take to remove him from office under the 25th Amendment if there was such evidence. William Banks is a professor of law at Syracuse University College of Law. And Professor, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Nice to be with you.
We've heard a little bit about the 25th Amendment, something that was discussed within the FBI as a possible way of removing the president. What is the 25th Amendment? How did it come about? What does the FBI have to do with it?
It's an interesting story. The 25th Amendment, as you can derive from its number, is the most recent. We don't have many amendments to our Constitution. It's a pretty difficult thing to do. And we lived through 160 or 170 years without a 25th Amendment, but there were some periods in our history when there was concern about a transition in leadership. If a president would become disabled or die while in office, does the vice president become the president? Does the vice president serve as an acting president? Does he continue simply to be vice president and we have no president? So finally, in the circumstances surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy, many were worried that what would have happened if Kennedy had been grievously wounded but not killed, and if he was essentially unable to perform the functions of office, but he wasn't dead. Of course, that didn't happen in this case, but that prompted Congress to write, draft, and then for three quarters of the states to ratify the 25th Amendment. It's not been invoked to in the case of the presidency since it was ratified by the states after Kennedy's assassination, but it has been utilized to replace the vice president on a couple of occasions. The operative term, it might be interesting for your listeners to know, is that the president can be removed if the vice president and a majority of the cabinet determines that he or she is, quote, unable to discharge the powers and duties, quote, end quote, of the office. So that's the standard, unable to discharge the powers and duties. And the mechanics are, again, you have to have the vice president and a majority of the cabinet arriving at that conclusion, and then the Congress can order the president's removal, but both chambers must say so by a two-thirds vote. So it's a very arduous process and a very high standard.
We've heard so many times that President Trump prefers the opinion of Vladimir Putin to that of his own intelligence agents. Would that be enough under the 25th Amendment to lead to the conclusion that he's unable to discharge his duties or that he might have allegiance to a foreign power?
Being compromised by a foreign power, particularly one who's perhaps an arch enemy of the United States over a long period of time, I think is a very serious charge. The president, of course, tends to say things off the cuff and even whimsically sometimes. And, you know, he had other instances where he made comments favorable about Russia and about Mr. Putin, but I don't know that that single comment about believing Putin in the case of the intelligence was sufficient to get over the bar.
What about seizing what appear to be congressional powers by declaring the state of emergency? He's been accused of seizing congressional powers by doing that. Is that something that would qualify under the 25th Amendment as making him unable to discharge the powers of his office?
I don't think so. I think that one of the difficulties here with the emergency declaration is that Congress created this opportunity for the president to follow this path. You know, the emergency proclamation is one that's permitted by statute, and it's one that's been around since 1976. It's been utilized around 50 times by presidents since the mid-70s, and the way forward is one that any president would welcome because it enables the proclamation of a national emergency, and it doesn't supply the criteria that have to be set out to describe the emergency. So whether or not most of us believe there's an emergency at the southern border, I do not. That really doesn't matter under the statute, because the president can declare a national emergency without regard to the characteristics of that emergency.
Could the courts be asked to determine that there was, in fact, not an emergency, therefore that the president's use of that power was inappropriate or unconstitutional?
It's possible, and many are paying attention to again, sort of offhand comments that the president made in his statement the other day, that he really didn't need to do that this way, but he was kind of in a hurry. And as I think it was Stephen Colbert said, that doesn't sound like an emergency, it sounds like a choice. That seems to me to be a pretty accurate characterization. So certainly a court could second guess the president's characterization of an emergency, but as many of us know, courts are wont to question the president's exercise of discretion, particularly in areas of national security and foreign affairs.
Okay, so Colbert talks about making a choice. Now, Charlie Sykes, a never-Trump conservative of some note, says Republican legislators have to make a choice. Do they support President Trump or the rule of law? Another conservative who's written about that is David French. He's a senior writer for the National Review. David French, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about this. Do Republican leaders, Lindsey Graham, the head of the Judiciary Committee now in the Senate, and the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, do they have to make a choice right now?
Well, I think that they are going to have to make a choice, because under the National Emergencies Act, the legislature can overrule the president. And so I would expect to see a resolution come out of the House that the Senate cannot avoid and will have to vote on. So you will see defections in the GOP from this national emergency declaration. There is considerable discontent. I don't think it is a majority discontent in the caucus. Or let's put it this way. There's a widespread discontent. I don't think it will express itself in a majority vote of the caucus against the president. I think there will be several defectors, maybe more defectors than we've seen on almost any other issue involving Trump. But they're probably not going to be able to duck putting themselves on the record about this national emergency. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, we've had enough congressional abdication of responsibility to the chief executive. A number of issues in the Trump administration have highlighted the extent to which Congress has abdicated its authority to the president on everything from the travel ban litigation, which is the parties were litigating a statute that gave the president enormous deference. Tariffs, Congress has given the president enormous deference, and the same with the National Emergencies Act. But I would say that the deference there is a little bit different, because the National Emergencies Act gives the president broad latitude to declare emergency, but that doesn't make the president king. It unlocks other statutes that sometimes are a little bit better drafted and have more limiting provisions.
In your article recently, you make the following statement, that partisans of the president are tripping over themselves to disregard the law in service of their imperial president. You said a moment ago that these laws don't make the president a king. As far as you're concerned, there's nothing new about this. President Obama and other presidents as well have, in fact, exceeded their authority under the Constitution, according to you.
Yes. Well, for example, I mean, let's just go for full circle in immigration. President Obama for years was arguing that he didn't have the authority to do what he later tried to do through DAPA and DACA, whereby writing a memorandum, his Secretary of Homeland Security changed the rules on the ground for hundreds of thousands of unlawful immigrants. And so that was an example where he directly defied a comprehensive statutory scheme. Now, what's interesting here is the Republicans, after being infuriated at the Obama administration action, and I think rightly angry at the Obama administration action, are now turning around and their own president is defying a comprehensive congressionally created statutory scheme of border protection. And in fact, he's much like Obama, how Obama specifically sought legislation from Congress, did not receive it, and then went with executive action. Trump specifically sought legislation from Congress, did not receive it, went with legislative action. And both of those actions are directly opposed to the fundamental structure of the Constitution, which is not that the president has sort of this imperial authority over and above Congress, that when Congress frustrates him, that gives him legal grounds to pursue action in defiance of Congress. We're seeing this come full circle, and we're learning quickly who's consistent and who's not on the constitutional structure of our government.
David French is with the National Review. I want to go back to William Banks, our professor at Syracuse University College of Law. Do you agree that past presidents and this one as well have, in fact, exceeded their authority, and that Congress, more importantly, I suppose, at the moment, has gone right along with it and abdicated its authority?
I think David makes several very good points, and I agree with all of them. I think there are a couple of things about this situation that's a little different than the Obama examples, for one. This is under the National Emergencies Act, and President Trump is the first president to seek to spend funds under the National Emergencies Act that had expressly been denied to him through the normal appropriations process. And indeed, looking at the lawfulness of his action going forward, the lawsuits that have been filed are going to ask judges to interpret those standby emergency authorities that allow for spending unobligated funds. And the principal one is something called the Military Construction Law. And the Military Construction Law only allows spending in situations that requires the use of the armed forces. I think it's going to be very difficult for the president's lawyers to persuade a judge that building the wall for the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection is a project that requires the use of the armed forces. Even though there's military deployed along the border, it's not their project. They won't be involved in the construction nor in the implementation and enforcement of the measure. So I think there's a difference about this particular situation. It's the first time this has happened. I think part of the blame does lay at Congress's feet here. I agree about the partisan ironies here. Republicans and Democrats should be aghast at the way that the emergency law is being treated by this president. So they should change it.
David French, do you think the Congress will go along with the idea that the armed forces are needed, or will they leave that up to the courts?
Well, I think the immediate congressional role will be the attempt to invalidate the emergency declaration itself. And unless there's massive defections on the GOP side, that's going to likely fail because they would need a veto-proof majority to invalidate the emergency declaration. That would be very, very difficult to get. And if they don't get that, then any legislative fix would take a long time and, again, have to have a veto-proof majority. So the attention will focus on the courts. And the relevant statute here is the National Emergencies Act is very broad. But the military construction law that he's citing is pretty darn precise. And in addition to saying that the emergency has to require the use of the armed forces, it also says that the construction funds must be used for military construction projects that are designed to support the use of the troops in the emergency. Now, if you go to other parts of the statute, you will see that these terms, military construction and military construction project, are defined terms under federal law. And what they mean is a military construction project is a building of a permanent structure or facility on a military installation. And so where's the military installation when you're building a civilian border wall? The statute, by its own terms, is designed to be applied. For example, to use Stephen Miller, Trump advisor Stephen Miller's own example, he said, no one would find it controversial if we use those funds to build a fence around an airbase in Bagram in Afghanistan. Well, of course not. That's a time of war. War requires the use of armed forces. Any fortification around a military installation is classic military construction. But what if we're at not war, we're building a border with an allied country, and we're not building a structure that is either on a military installation or even one that will be used by the military? It's a civilian structure for use by civilian border enforcement authorities. The statute just flat out doesn't apply. And the courts, if the courts were going to turn a blind eye to this in the name of granting enormous deference to the president whenever he invokes the term national security, my submission is that's a direct rejection of any sort of originalism and textualism. And so I would be surprised to even see some of these Trump appointee judges go along with it.
Okay, so we've talked about the judiciary, we've talked about statutes, we've talked about the Constitution. Let me ask you, David French, what's your take on the report by Andrew McCabe, the former acting director of the FBI now, contained in his book, about Mr. Rosenstein and the possibility of using a wire to find out what the president really thinks or test his motivations or whatever it was that they discussed? How important is that?
Well, it's really hard for me to say for a really important reason, and that is Mr. McCabe has been, you mentioned earlier, he was fired for leaking, but it was more than just the leaking. He was fired for leaking and for not telling the truth to government investigators. So this is a guy who has had a casual relationship with the truth in the past. So whenever I hear from someone who has that kind of documented history, I'm instantly skeptical. What were the circumstances? Were there anyone else who can? Is there anyone else who can corroborate this? And I think that this is something that is a serious enough allegation, along with the 25th Amendment, for example, along with the allegation that Trump was believing Putin over our own intelligence agencies, that we need to swear people in, hear witnesses, see if there are any corroborating witnesses who can tell the same story. So my view of it, when this happens, and when these kinds of claims are made, is pretty simple. It's, okay, I'm concerned enough to where I'm going to ask you to prove it, or I'm going to ask congressional investigators to get to the bottom of this. But because of his past record, I'm not going to necessarily believe it in either the main thrust of it or the particulars.
Well, that past record was compiled by the Inspector General of the Justice Department. Mr. McCabe has claimed that it isn't true, so there is some doubt about it. William Banks, do you know anything about that? And if so, how important is that dispute? And will we have to see it worked out someplace?
Well, I think worked out someplace is exactly right. And I agree with David that there should be an opportunity for sworn testimony, either in Congress or elsewhere. It would be Congress, I suspect, probably Lindsey Graham's committee. There was another person in the room, as reported in McCabe's book and I think in Adam Goldman's story last fall, and that was the general counsel, then general counsel, no longer the general counsel of the FBI, a man by the name of James Baker, Jim Baker. And apparently Baker's reaction was to, pick himself up off the floor at the ridiculousness of the idea and to just throw cold water on it immediately at that point. And if Baker is no longer in the government, but if he were around to corroborate that, I think that would help put things in context.
But does that go to the truth or falsity of what Mr. McCabe has said?
Well, it may actually corroborate McCabe if it prompted Baker to metaphorically fall on the floor.
So, David French, in other words, maybe McCabe has a stronger case.
He might. I think the thing is, when you're talking about issues of this importance, wearing a wire, 25th Amendment, nuance and circumstance matter a lot. Is something raised in sort of gallows humor jest? Is something raised as an affirmative actual proposal? The context really, really matters. And as of right now, based on the facts that are available in the public record regarding McCabe's truthfulness, I don't necessarily believe that he's a trustworthy messenger. He may be right. He may be, in this instance, telling the truth. But when you're talking about things of this importance, 25th Amendment, never invoked for a president, or when you're talking about believing a hostile foreign powers dictator over our own intelligence services, again, I'm not aware of that precedent existing. These are things that require a heck of a lot more inquiry, and I think it's our attitude should be: my eyebrows are raised, I'm concerned, but I'm not going to press the alarm button until I have more information.
So obviously these matters are going to be up for dispute probably for a long time to come. William Banks, you said that Congress ought to change the law. How should it change the law so we could avoid going into the kind of situation we're in now?
With regard to the National Emergencies Act, I think there are a couple of simple reforms that would improve it greatly. One is to attach a sunset to every emergency proclamation so that it expires, say, after 90 days or 6 months, and require a new proclamation and an approval by Congress if it's to be extended. The second would be to establish some criteria for what counts as an emergency and what does not. The simple sunset would go a long ways. There is a mechanism in the law now that requires Congress to come every 6 months for a vote to continue the emergency, but Congress has simply ignored that requirement, and there are no implications for them having done so. So if the emergency itself would expire, action would have to be taken.
So, David French, presumably it'll be a long, long time before Congress gets around to actually talking about changing the law because they have to cope with the law we have now. But would that satisfy you if there were a sunset on the proclamations? Would that ease your concern about the abdication of power on the part of the Congress?
I would like to see a sunset where it could only be renewed with the consent of both houses of Congress, but I might even get a little more strict and articulate that the circumstances in which a national emergency can be declared are limited, for example, to instances of actual armed conflict or the imminent threat of armed conflict or natural disasters or perhaps unfolding economic disasters. Because the clear intent of this was not to, and in fact, you know, if you read the legislative history, the intent here was actually to restrict presidents. Very poorly drafted statute, if that was the intent to restrict presidents. But the intent here was to restrict presidents. The intent was pretty clear that these national emergencies were to be declarations were to be utilized when events were unfolding so quickly, and events were unfolding in such a way, and events were so serious that the president had to act before Congress could act. There's nothing like that here. Nothing like that here. So, you know, it's always better when the text of a statute reflects the intent of a statute. And in this case, it's the intent and the actual text are quite far apart. And so what has to happen is if Congress is prudent going forward, it has to narrow the criteria, I think, in addition to sunsetting any given declaration.
Back to the issue of presidential politics, Speaker Pelosi has even mentioned that a Democrat of the future could, following the pattern set by this president and perhaps by President Obama as well, use this for climate change or for gun control of some kind. Are you, David French, concerned about that?
Oh, absolutely. Now, you know, one of the things that Republicans need to keep in mind as they're busy defending this emergency declaration is unlike the situation at the border, there's actual Pentagon findings around the problem of climate change, the problem that climate change presents to national security. So there are pre-existing Pentagon authorities expressing concern about the impact of climate change on American national security. And so this is not just some sort of pie in the sky scenario. It's an actual presently existing. When I was in the military, I served for 10 years in the Judge Advocate General Corps. When I was in the military, we conducted briefings on this issue, on the issue of the national security threat of climate change. And so I listened to those briefings. I was part of some of those briefings. And so the idea that this is so fantastical and you don't have to worry about what a Democratic president's going to do, I think that's nonsense. But you know what happens in Washington is it seems like every party, once they get in power, a part of their brain turns off and they act as if they will always be in power, as if the winning will never stop. And nothing about American history supports that view. And so any precedent set by one party, what recent history shows, will not just be followed by the next, but often amplified and enhanced by the party that comes next.
So, William Banks, do we, in fact, then often see more continuity between presidents, whether they be of one party or the other, than we do difference and change.
I think history proves that to be the case. And I agree with David that there's a real opportunity here for Republicans and Democrats to recognize the threat to democracy that's posed by the discretion that Congress gave to the president more than 40 years ago. Big changes should be made in this law. And I think, there is a silver lining. I think it's likely that there'll be serious effort put into reforming the National Emergencies Act this year. There's been a project ongoing to reform the act at the Brennan Center at New York University for some time now that's suddenly sparked by this particular controversy. Many of us have recognized the problems with the act long before President Trump's episode.
Well, thank you both very much for being on our program, and we will look forward to what happens next, and particularly if this effort to change takes place. William Banks, come back and talk to us about it, and David French, we'd love to have you back again as well. Again, William Banks is with the Syracuse University School of Law. David French, also an attorney, is with the National Review. Thank you both.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Carolinas are being swamped by these heavy rains and high winds from Hurricane Florence.
The best scientists in the world are all telling us that our activities are changing the climate.
I don't think it's a hoax. I think there's probably a difference, but I don't know that it's man-made.
Experts say that we have until 2030 to avoid catastrophe.
Since it was founded by Richard Nixon, the Environmental Protection Agency has been assigned to protect the health of Americans from radiation and toxic chemicals in the air, in the water, on the ground, wherever they might be found, whatever the amount of pollution. The assumption has always been if a lot is bad, then so is a little, and no safe thresholds have been set above zero. Now, the Trump EPA is proposing a change on the advice of a controversial scientist, Ed Calabrese, of the University of Massachusetts. For decades, he has been snubbed by mainstream public health scientists for claiming that small amounts of some toxic materials can even be good for the health of human beings. Let's pick up the story there with Suzanne Rust. She is an investigative reporter specializing in environmental issues for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for talking to me.
Tell us about Ed Calabrese and his history.
He's a tenured professor at the University of Massachusetts. He started his career as a toxicologist working, as most toxicologists do, with public agencies, looking at particulates in water and soil. At some point in the 1980s, the tobacco industry and he began a relationship. And since then, he has promoted this idea that low levels of cancer-causing agents and radiation are beneficial to human health. And he has done research in the area, but more than anything, he has promoted the science by creating a journal that looks just at low doses and their benefits. He's created an international society, and he's really been a proselytizer and an advocate for this idea.
As to the tobacco industry, you report that in 1985, he reached out to them, and one of their advisors said this is the Mad Hatter's Tea Party of epidemiological approach, but now he's working for them.
I don't think he's actually working for them anymore. But yes, it would seem to be a contentious relationship initially. Looking through documents that the University of California at San Francisco has archived, and you can look at them online, they're all the tobacco industry documents that were revealed during discovery. You can see that the tobacco industry actually first reached out to him to find out if he had any interest, and he wrote them a proposal that they found looking at the notes and the reviewers, ridiculous and crazy. However, I suspect the tobacco industry didn't have that many legitimate scientists seeking them out. So over time, he was able to change his message and research into a way that they really liked. And that way was this idea that low doses of chemicals, cancer-causing ones, radiation, are actually good for you. And it was an idea and a paradigm that clearly the tobacco industry embraced.
He's even talked about the loss of benefits associated with smoking.
Yes. So in one of the proposals that he sent to them, he said he would look at the not just a cigarette that they were interested in, but the idea that if somebody were to stop smoking, they could actually suffer as a result.
Who agrees with that other than Calabrese and the tobacco industry?
So he's also been funded by ExxonMobil, the U.S. Air Force, which is one of the biggest producers of toxic waste sites in the country, Dow Chemical, General Electric. So a lot of major industries that are known for being major polluters as well have sought this idea for years and years and years and have funded research to suggest that it may be more valid than initially believed. However, just as an aside, there are examples in clinics, pharmacological settings where the idea that something of a small dose that is at large doses could be harmful are good. Most of the medications we take at low doses can be beneficial. The difference is you have a doctor prescribing something for you and monitoring you in that case. And what Calabrese and his funders are seeking here is the idea that this kind of regulation should be set on all public health and environmental health risk assessments, and that's a very different situation.
Other than smoking, what are we talking about? What kinds of chemicals, and does this include radiation as well?
Yeah, so this includes radiation. It includes just about every polluting chemical you can think of. The PCBs, dioxin, endocrine disruptors, what he says is that small doses of anything just end up stimulating cells in the system, sort of like the idea that you might not eat in a while, that actually can enhance the system for a little bit before it goes bad. So he says this is a general universal rule and you can apply it everywhere.
Well, of course, you can kill yourself by drinking too much water, but that doesn't mean that you want to do it. So what does he now have to do with the EPA?
So what we understand now, and this was research I was able to get by filing a public records request to the University of Massachusetts, he was solicited by the EPA, in particular a deputy administrator who also used to work with the tobacco industry, to provide his thoughts and ideas about how the EPA should begin looking at risk assessments. Or actually not to begin, but how maybe they could overturn the way the EPA has looked at chemicals and radiation for the past 50 years. So this deputy administrator, Clint Woods, reached out to Calabrese. He provided his advice, sent them three sentences, and those three sentences were basically word for word incorporated into the Federal Register last April to set proposed new policy for the EPA, the way they would go forward assessing dangerous chemicals and radiation.
And Calabrese has, in fact, emailed others saying, according to your story, this is a major big-time victory.
Yes. He emailed a man named Steve Malloy, who used to be a coal lobbyist, is a prominent climate denier. He calls people who believe in climate change bedwetters. The two were emailing about their joy over this new proposed rule.
Well, what does Calabrese have to say about all of these people that, if there are corporations that you mentioned, the notorious polluters, who have funded him?
He says they just happen to be aligned on this one scientific theory. He doesn't care where his money comes from. It doesn't influence his research at all. He just was lucky that the research that he has pursued and finds is interesting is also one that is funded by major polluters.
Well, now, in the past, though, he has had support not just from the polluters, but also from Cal EPA and the Environmental Protection Agency itself under others who didn't necessarily buy this idea that small amounts of pollution are good for you.
So the research that Dr. Calabrese did for Cal EPA and EPA, at least since 2000, has not been on this idea that low doses of cancer-causing agents are good for you. Been on how construction workers inhale soil while they are working. So some of the work he does has been the kind of thing that state and federal agencies have been interested and want to know more about.
How does he get what legitimacy he has?
So Dr. Calabrese, he is well-funded. He publishes extensively, and he has also created his own journal, the Dose Response Journal, which is an academic peer-reviewed journal, as well as his own International Dose Response Society. And he began those in the 1990s, and as time has gone by, I suspect people haven't realized where those societies and journals started and where the money comes for them. And so he has created and built a career that looks legitimate from the outside.
What kind of money has he received?
Since 1990, he has received upwards of $8 million from the U.S. Air Force, which is, again, has Superfund sites all over the country, from ExxonMobil, Dow Chemical, the tobacco industry, et cetera.
What about the concentration of pollutants amongst various elements of the population? And has Calabrese studied that when he says that some amounts of pollution can be good for you?
Well, so you've just hit on one of the biggest concerns by most public health officials and toxicologists. There is what Dr. Calabrese says is, he says, if you look in a laboratory and you give a certain chemical to some cells, they may show a stimulatory effect. And he thinks that effect is universal and therefore should be applied across the entire population and environment. What most public health officials and toxicologists will say to you is, yes, you may see isolated examples of this. However, what you aren't incorporating into that is the idea that a human being, like you or me, is also exposed to hundreds, if not thousands, tens of thousands of different chemicals. And we have no idea how that one chemical you are testing will interact with those others. And all of us carry different concentrations, different payloads of this stuff. And it's just it's an unknown. So trying to suggest that a small level of one chemical is good for somebody without looking at it outside of that context is incredibly dangerous.
You report that, according to Calabrese, the pushback he gets comes from left-of-center toxicologists and other extreme environmentalists who see him as the devil incarnate. Is he right? Do they see him as the devil incarnate?
I think there are some who do. I think there are others who are very concerned about his push, who believe that he is really a agent of industry out there to allow industry to reduce their own costs at the expense of public health. There are others who find some of his research interesting and curious, but again, don't want to see it applied as environmental policy or regulation, and others who until recently never thought much about him because he was always sort of a curiosity.
And now here he is with the APA. Now, how many responses have there been to the proposal that is made in those three sentences you mentioned?
According to the EPA, 590,000 comments have been submitted since the proposal was announced at the end of last April. I do believe the comment period is over. So during the comment period, 590,000 comments were submitted.
Do we know what proportion was favorable as opposed to unfavorable? Or?
You know, I started trying to quantify that and I gave up after a few. So no, I do not know.
What kind of responses have you had to your article? It's only been out for a few days.
It's still early, largely incredulity. People can't believe that this kind of policy is being set by somebody who has such clear industry background. Public health officials, or not public health officials, but toxicologists and epidemiologists who are really concerned about what this would mean for public and environmental health.
Well, you're a student of the EPA and of the administration's policies toward the environment. You made a comparison a moment ago, or you cited others who do make a comparison between this situation and climate change denial. What about climate change denial, and is this comparable?
Yes, I do think this is a very comparable situation. What often happens in these contentious kind of scientific issues where you find out that industry has been around for a while is they have spent years and years and years presenting research, funding research that promotes their point of view. And it was clear there was sort of a dark money going into climate change research for years that would poke holes in what most researchers thought. Generally, the same people in the same corporations who are doing that in this case about risk assessments and dose assessments. Clear things that can affect our environment and public health for the worse.
President Trump likes to hold snowballs, saying that there is no global warming. And he uses that to say that climate change isn't happening.
So I think there's one of the things I have learned in my long career now of studying how science is used in policy is industry often funds a kind of science that supports their work and benefits them. And what they do is they create sort of the semantics of how they explain things or the way they frame something is often very simple to understand. So when we began learning about how the climate was changed, the idea was carbon dioxide was up there in the atmosphere, and there was sort of an idea that it was like a greenhouse, right, that heat would be trapped, and so global warming suddenly came out. But as more research came in, it was understood that it's not just things will become warmer, but everything is likely to change. But what industry has done is they have stuck to that global warming phrase to show that, look, things are getting colder over here, or this is not happening over here, to basically debunk the idea that something is actually happening. It's a framework they have used over and over and over again to confuse and to promote the sense of doubt.
So here we are again now with Ed Calabresi's ideas being entertained and perhaps made into public policy by the Trump EPA. Suzanne Rust, it is great to have you with us as always. Come back, talk to us again.
I will. Thank you for having me.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody with audio assistance from Chris Wotherspoon. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetary. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again. Subscribe if you haven't already. Let us know what you think of our podcast. Tweet us at tothepoint_KCRW or email me at warren.olney@kcrw.org. You can be a reviewer. Thanks for listening.